Okay. In one of my emails, I said we had a rock star talking to us, and I want to show you what I mean by that. There we go. This is Larry. This was done back in August, and it's everything you ever wanted to know about Larry Schlesinger. So we have that. This isn't just in October. This was one of the pieces here. And then it's talking about him all through this article. And so I was duly impressed. And for those of you who went to the last meeting we had in Dallas, which was in February, gosh, that seems like forever ago, we had Kathleen Gibson from San Antonio, from Southwestern Medical Foundation, which is the foundation for UT Southwestern. And she gave us last year's Perspectives, which is a lovely, lovely magazine. And so we all got a copy of this, and I'm browsing through it. And by golly, here's our San Antonio person in the North Texas magazine. That is very impressive. So there you have it. And let me tell you a little bit about him before we get started. Dr. Larry Schlesinger is the president and CEO of Texas Biomedical Research Institute, where he is leading a transformational change process to develop Texas Biomed into a world-renowned infectious disease research institution that is twice its current size, with a focus on diseases impacting our lives today and in the future. Dr. Schlesinger aims to revolutionize the way scientists perform science, focusing on greater collaboration and a holistic approach to studying disease from basic biology to the development of diagnostics, therapies, and vaccines. His passion lies in the development of people and programs that will have innovative, lasting impact on human health. He will share thoughts on how Texas can capitalize on its pioneering and collaborative spirit to become an even greater force in biomedicine on the global stage in the coming years. It's all yours, Larry.
Larry, you have to unmute yourself.
Okay.
There you go.
So I wanted to say that I am always humbled by Linda's introductions of me, blasting all these newspaper articles and magazines. Thank you, Linda. I appreciate it. And it's always a lot of fun to be here with you and to be able to talk to your eclectic group out there throughout Texas. My first order of business is we have a brand new guest to San Antonio who's on today, Dr. Akuto Onyanwu, who's on the screen. You may have seen her already, and I'll be introducing her at the end of my comments and tell you a little bit about herself, because I'm terribly excited that she's joined Texas Biomed from Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. So with that, I prepared comments that should last about 20 minutes or so. And then Dr. Onyanwu will speak a few minutes, but we'll have plenty of time for Q&A, and I don't mind being interrupted if something isn't clear or you have something you want to add to my comments. And the topic today is the role of preclinical research in medicine. And I put some slides together to hopefully provide you with some more information about what it means, what's the importance of preclinical research in medicine, and then move on to exactly how that's playing an incredible role in COVID-19 and the pandemic, and specifically then the role Texas Biomed plays in preclinical research and the role we're playing with COVID. So that's really my presentation today. So I'll move forward with that and control the slides. Let me see if I can, it may have froze or something here. Let me take a second. huh, haven't had that happen before. Give me a second, I'm going to come out and go back in. Maybe I need to do it a little differently. I just love this technology, you know? Okay. All right. Okay, I think that will work. So, you know, I wanted to start with defining preclinical research. And a classical sense, preclinical biomedical research are scientific disciplines that traditionally have been studied before introducing patient care. Okay, so that makes sense. It's preclinical. And there are several aims to preclinical research that include understanding basic biological processes, which is directly relevant to COVID, SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, the so-called host-pathogen interactions in the context of infectious diseases, and then the safety and efficacy of diagnostics, therapies, and vaccines are all included in preclinical biomedical research and play quite an important role in what we're doing today. You know, this in the context of drug discovery, this is the rather classic pipeline that I just want to make sure we're all on the same page with this. In moving from your left to right, if we're talking about the drug discovery process in general, it's a 10 to 15 year process at best. And in the context of drugs, it would start with very basic research on identifying targets. You know, for those who are reading about the current virus, it would be the receptor, the ACE2 receptor, for example. And that is the start of designing drugs and screening compound libraries. And that's very expensive. And already at that early juncture, it could be outsourced, costing millions. And then one needs to actually distill a lot of information in the basic science arena to get to what are called lead hits. And, you know, together you're already looking at nearly $20 million of even preclinical research to even have a chance. All of that traditionally goes on before moving to what you're hearing about every day today, the phase 1, 2, and 3 clinical studies. Phase 1 is a small study, usually 50 to 100 people are engaged in that. And it's really to bring forward a package on a lead compound and prove safety in humans. So you already have to have manufacturing and process to go to the clinical trials, at least to some extent, so safe drugs in a human. Phase 2 is a larger study, which may be on the level of hundreds of people, that continues to evaluate safety in a broader context and also begins to look at the efficacy of the drug. And then phase 3 is primarily efficacy, and that's tens of thousands of people, large studies, and that's where we are right now with SARS-CoV-2 therapies and vaccines. And all of that is to get to FDA approval. So I want you to know that only about 13% of drugs that make it through the three phases actually get FDA approved, 13%. And so there's a lot of problems along the way, and I'm going to talk about some of those today, that maybe derail the process of drug discovery or vaccine discoveries. And that's one point that I wanted to make in the context of today's conversation. Now, specifically in the same pipeline, it's incredibly important to understand the role of animals. Animal science, animal use of animals in science is a touchy subject for some individuals and one that requires its own full discussion. But the reality is they are essential in anything we bring to humans in terms of testing therapies and vaccines, even today. There are other models coming on the scene, but they're early. And so animal models are necessary, and they are the model that bringing your COVID-19 vaccine to phase 3 trials. So animals come in very early in the pipeline, starting with even proof of concept when you're still working through, let's say, compounds that may serve as drugs or vaccines. And then even to lead optimization, where typically one is using animals to look at the best candidates. And usually these are small animals, by and large rodents. We're talking about mice, but in the case of COVID-19, it also includes hamsters and ferrets. And then one moves to what are called GLP studies. I'll come back to that, this good laboratory practice studies, which really are the studies that companies want to look at toxicity, efficacy, and safety. Those are critical. And in the case of SARS-CoV-2, it's the primate model, so large animals. And then we talk about IND. Now, what I want to tell you is that typically all of this occurs before even phase one clinical trials, I shown on the previous slide. And one of the ways we've cut down time is that we're doing some of this in parallel with humans and animals. And so that's something new in the current pandemic. Now, why are animals so important in the preclinical space? Well, obviously they're important for testing drugs and vaccines, that's clear. But really they're gonna help us understand more about how a disease occurs because you can do things in a more, what is called controlled fashion. We can understand transmission better, and that's still somewhat controversial. I would say not really in the case of SARS-CoV-2. We can learn about whether reinfection actually occurs in a controlled setting, which is a very active question out there today. And we can learn whether some drugs or vaccines actually do more harm than good by something called antibody-mediated immune enhancements, a fancy term to mean that in some individuals, a therapy or vaccine may ramp up the immune system so much that one actually gets sicker from the drug or vaccine than they did from the natural infection. That all can be studied in a controlled fashion in animals. Now, to do animal studies is complex and expensive. You got to pick the right animal model, the model that best recapitulates humans. You have to understand what strain, which virus are you going to use? And is it the same virus that is used in the natural population? Are there more than one strain? The dose and timing, some of which is still not clear, even in the case of providing a vaccine to humans. One needs to consider variables such as age and sex. One needs to be concerned that the virus you're using in animal studies actually becomes adapted to the animal and is no longer the fully so-called virulent strain used in humans. One needs to understand the animal rule. So Text Biomed's been involved in studies with Ebola virus. It is not ethical to do clinical trials in humans with a virus that can cause death 80% of the time. And so the animal rule says if you have two animals at least, that recapitulate human disease, that might short circuit to phase three clinical trials. That's called the animal rule. And one needs to have the proper facilities to do research, the biocontainment facilities. A number of objective criteria need to be developed to validate an animal model. These are clinical parameters, so-called viral load, the amount of virus in the animal, so-called immunological readouts, and histopathology. That is the disease in the tissues, all needs to be worked out in the animal. And companies require this all be standardized in order to go to the FDA with the study results. So there's a premium on reproducibility, and therefore one needs to standardize and do GLP. Now, this is a big deal, this good laboratory practice. This is a level of rigor with quality assurance and control that the FDA listens to, and not a lot of places don't do that. Particularly universities are not necessarily set up for GLP science. So all of that goes into the importance of animals in the pipeline of preclinical investigation to clinical. Again, I'm happy to answer any questions along the way. I'll just keep going until maybe I'm interrupted because I have it in full screen, so I'm not seeing the chat. All right, so now take everything I've just been talking about and put it in the context of the COVID-19 vaccine pipeline. So on the left-hand side, I've showed you the idea that you start with compounds and the use of small models, animal models to large animals like a monkey. And then one moves to the phase one through three trials. Phase four trial is actually post-marketing after a drug or a vaccine has been approved, and now it's given out to the masses, and then one is continuing to collect data to see if it continues to be safe. Now, the normal pipeline, as I've already said, is at best about 15 to 20 years. And here we are trying to get this done in a year or two. Now, part of how this is happening is science. Because if you all remember, we had an outbreak of SARS many years ago. At that point, we didn't know what was causing this respiratory problem in humans that came from China and traveled the world. And it took, in record time, about 3 months to identify the pathogen as a virus. We then had an outbreak of Middle Eastern virus, MERS, and that was a coronavirus, just like the SARS virus is a coronavirus. So we learned about that more quickly. And then with this current outbreak of coronavirus, the virus itself, because we knew it was a coronavirus, was fully sequenced in 2 weeks. So what took 3 months for SARS took 2 weeks with this virus. And within a month, there were vaccine companies like Moderna thinking about manufacturing vaccines. So part of the speed was science that told us what the pathogen was from previous outbreaks. And then, as I've said, we're doing animal and human studies somewhat in parallel, working with companies and the FDA as an integrated structure to get to the finish line. And so, you know, we can talk about what that means in terms of outcomes, but it's unprecedented. We've never had a situation like this go as quickly. Now, one of the challenges of infectious disease in general is shown on this slide. If you look at the upper right of the slide, I'm showing you model examples of some of our outbreaks, pandemic influenza, Zika, Ebola, and SARS. And here is a little structure that's the outbreak starting. And typically what goes on and went on here with SARS-CoV-2 is it's the virus is kind of going along and infecting people, and then it has an outbreak. And when that outbreak begins, people start getting interested. So not until things start getting crazy does the media pick it up, money come in, industry get involved. And then there's all kinds of activity like is going on now with therapies, vaccines, diagnostics. And then the problem has been, at least historically, like with SARS, the money goes away, the media goes away, and there's not a sustainable financial structure for the next outbreak. So this is called reactive, and it's never fast enough. So we reacted to SARS-CoV-2. Now, what should it look like? In the proactive mode, which is really my personal vision of where we have to go going forward, is that we have a 24/7 operation that upfront is working on some of these potential pathogens that are out there in the world and increasing in frequency. So that by the time there is an outbreak, we are already primed to move quickly with lead candidates for therapies and vaccines ahead of time. That is the new vision, has never occurred before, requires new structure. But other than that, we're going to be in the same mode we are now, reacting. And some, you know, more cynical types might say we haven't learned a whole lot past the 1918 influenza outbreak in terms of the measures we're taking until we have a therapy and a vaccine. So I wanted to put that out there as something, a challenge for the future. Okay, so another drawback is that this whole preclinical pipeline, which based on the title of the paper, I call the Academic Drug Discovery Pipeline, is actually looks like this, more like a mess. It is not a tight forward functioning system. It's actually more of a wandering road where the blue ovals are actually the milestones that you would want to get to success, shown here as green balls. So the blues are the go-no-goes, and then the green are the success. But the red structures here are actually all the derailments, if you take the railroad analogy. And the derailments of any new drug far exceed the blue and the green balls. That's the point. So this is what we've been plagued with, all the ways in which we're disjointed. Some of it is outsourcing with many different places. Some of it is caught up in money or faculty leaving institutions if they're at universities, et cetera. So the future, in addition to be proactive, needs to be streamlined. It needs to really be a combination of public-private partnerships where you have great science going on at the discovery level, but working with organizations that have specialized research in areas that can translate some of this more efficiently, that has in-house some of the technology necessary, and can also serve as intermediaries with companies, with pharma, in a much more organized fashion. So the future would be proactive and partnerships. And that would be the new way to think about infectious diseases success. Now, let me bring this then back to Texas Biomed and what role we play in the preclinical pipeline. And I will say everywhere. And in fact, it highlights some of the unique features of our institute. We are a bit of a unicorn in this space and why we're being successful. So our mission is to pioneer and share breakthroughs that protect you, your families, and the global community from the threat of infectious diseases. And so we have a number of unique aspects to our institute. We do cutting edge science. So we do discovery based science to understand infectious diseases and also susceptible populations like the elderly, diabetes, obesity. We have research going on. And our goal is us to deliver that science in the context of diagnostic therapies and vaccines. We operate essentially under GLP practices in our containment facilities. And as we speak today, we have 6 biocontainment level 3 facilities necessary to study a virus like SARS-CoV-2, and the only privately owned BSL-4, which has enabled us to make major discoveries with, for example, Ebola virus. We're one of 7 national primate centers, so we have those small and large animals for research, and experienced professionals in handling those primates with care, as we heard from Linda before we started today. We do things really well. But we're a business. We have a flat organizational structure, so we're nimble and responsive. I'm by nature an anti-bureaucrat, and I like to get to yes before no. So we are actually combining business practices with discovery research and also conducting contract sciences with companies and a long history of working with the FDA. So this unique combination of assets exists nowhere else in the country. And then finally, and importantly, we are the voice of science. That is fact, to talk about fact rather than fiction. My background as a physician scientist in infectious diseases is more aligned with Tony Fauci in the way I think about public health and public health measures. So Texas Biomed's moving science faster, forward faster to discover, deliver, and save lives. I mean, that is really our goal, and we are singularly focused on that. We've had tremendous success over the years along the line of preclinical research. To highlight, just this week, you heard in the news that Regeneron got FDA approval for the first new drug for Ebola virus. But what you don't know is that all the preclinical work was done at Texas Biomed that enabled Regeneron to bring that drug, for example, to the Democratic Republic of Congo and eliminate the more recent outbreak. HIV, you probably don't know this. Back in the early 1980s, blood was delivered from a patient infected on the West Coast to Texas Biomed and injected in a chimpanzee as the first indication of an animal model for HIV. That paper was published in Science Magazine with Tony Fauci. That work was done at Texas Biomed. Hepatitis B and C. The Nobel Prize was awarded to these 3 gentlemen last week for the discovery of Hep C. Dr. Alter was an adjunct faculty member at Texas Biomed. The other 2 worked extensively at Texas Biomed. Why? Because the discovery of Hep C required its identification as the causative agent, a virus, Hep C, in chimpanzees, all done at Texas Biomed. The hepatitis B vaccine that we use when we travel was done at Texas Biomed. And today we have big programs in drug-resistant malaria and tuberculosis, working with our animals in diagnostics, therapies, and vaccines. So we've been doing this for a very long time. And in with the Hep B vaccine story and the Ebola therapy story, in close partnership with governmental agencies like BARDA and with industry and the FDA. Okay, I want to finish up here with some of the comments about COVID-19 and Texas Biomed. So where are we today? That's a whole other hour, Linda, which I don't have time for, but we're still trying to understand the virus. That's, to me, the greatest challenge of getting to a vaccine is very quickly trying to understand the virus in all its aspects, the preclinical, if you will. We do know it's airborne in these droplets and aerosols, and I will tell you that there should be no dispute about 50 years of science on the utility of masks and physical distancing. They're essential to curtail airborne viruses. The preclinical pipeline is robust. There's never been more people leaning in worldwide, and vaccine trials are ongoing. I'll talk just a moment about that. We are still challenged by point of care rapid diagnostics, and I'm so pleased with our partners in the city and community labs right now launching a high volume testing center, so critical for COVID-19. Congratulations, BioBridge Global, and the folks launching that with Graham Weston and Bruce Bug and Tullis Wells. And then I would finish by saying this thing's going to be with us for a long time. So I could talk more about it, but I don't think there's any indication that this virus will go away. Did you know that there are 89 preclinical vaccines under active investigation today? 89 in that preclinical pipeline? And in the clinical trials, look at the numbers of vaccines. You hear about a couple on the news, but we have a very robust pipeline. And I cannot tell you today which one's going to make it to the finish line for FDA approval or even emergency authorization. We'll know a lot more about lead vaccines by November, December. But manufacturing, in my opinion, is still a big hurdle. And I think it's going to be, broad distribution will await 2021 or 2022. I think therapies, on the other hand, will come on the market sooner. And look at the pipeline for therapies for SARS-CoV-2. 550 plus drugs in development and planning stages. The preclinical pipeline is very robust for the therapies. There are a variety of different therapies shown here in the upper right. You're hearing mostly about the neutralizing antibodies, but there are others as well. And we have so many early and late stage clinical trials for therapy. I do think we'll get approval faster for therapy for, particularly for hospitalized patients to reduce death faster than we'll get to a vaccine. Now, Texas Biomed has been doing a lot in this space. So we've established non-human primate and mouse models. So we have small and large models. We did this by community support last March, where people came in with contributions that helped us launch very quickly and be a national leader. Here are two papers in Nature magazine, magazines that will be coming out shortly from Texas Biomed. Today, we're collaborating with three Operation Warp Speed companies. And perhaps you didn't know that we're the company that did the Pfizer vaccine, which may make it to the finish line first. We are in fact working with 30 companies and have many partnerships. We're studying diabetes and aging and with SARS-CoV-2. And we have a number of papers and even licensing agreements on SARS-CoV-2 as we speak today. Maybe you'll know us best for this one. So Regeneron, who I've already told you we have a working relationship with, has two monoclonal antibodies, a cocktail, that the president received. The Regeneron product was done at Texas Biomed in the preclinical space. This is the Science Magazine article that was published 2 weeks ago. And eight authors on this publication are Texas Biomed from the work we did in the monkeys. And the work in the monkeys with this therapy looked really excellent and helped promote the clinical trials that are going on today. Let me finish up by saying that we've done some really strategic moves based on our mission focused heavily on infectious diseases. We brought in a new vice president for business development and strategic alliances, Corey Hallam. And believe it or not, he joined us in March at the time the outbreak was launched. And here's what we've done this year. We just crossed $40 million in contract work since January. And we have a robust screening pipeline working with companies. And here are some of the companies we're working with. And our goal is not just contract for COVID-19, but we're developing long-term relationships with these companies. And I think this will be really the future, as I talked early on about the vision of proactive, sustainable infrastructure. And I think we're coming along very well on this. I know many companies are really hurting, and I'm sensitive to that. It's kind of, I smile when I say, but infectious diseases is our business. So we've been in it from the start. We have lost some business, as all companies do. But what's important to say is we've maintained really close working relationships, and we're collecting more, if you will, business EQ and marketing. And I think we'll eventually have more, some of these companies back, come back to us. Well, what happens when you do all this work? You create what I call SOS, or the struggles of success. So you build a monster, and then you have to feed the monster. And we are wall to wall busy. And all of a sudden we're malaligned because we need more space, we need more personnel. So this is the monster we've created. And as such, as part of our 10-year strategic plan, which has a cost of about $250 to $300 million, we launched a $24 million phase one urgent goal to increase capacity for all the work so we can get more drugs and vaccines tested to come to market. And right now we are working on a building we're calling NHP Alpha, which is a multi-species primate facility built. It'll be the first one on our campus in 20 years for monkeys, 800 of them, a $10 million facility. And this has been ignited by the fact that we were able to acquire $4 million from the Federal CARES Act to help ignite the building. And so we're now working on, through our campaign, matching that. So part of our success in building our preclinical pipeline will be business, but the final piece will be development. And we've had a vice president for advancement, Corby Christie. Some of you know him. He's been with us 20 years and he's retiring. Wonderful man, committed. But in thinking about our goal to be a global leader in this space, we were very fortunate through a national competitive search to identify Dr. Akuto Anyanwu from Johns Hopkins, where she was an associate dean. She's not currently an associate dean. She started with us in September, but she's still in Maryland. She's has an MD and also has a master's of science in public health from Harvard. And she has done an enormous amount of work in the global health space internationally, winning awards for some of the work she's done. And I wanted to end by introducing her to you today because she's new to our community. Ask her to say a few words about herself and about why she's with us and what her goals would be. And then we'll open it up for Q&A. Is that okay, Linda? That's pretty much, so I wanna get out of share screen and allow Akuto to say a few words.
Thank you, Larry. And thank you, Linda, for the opportunity to be with you all today. I've read quite a bit about the health think tank and your vision in starting this group many years ago. And I think it's a great thing that you've done. I think it really is an effort that will lead to San Antonio becoming a hub for biomedical research. It sounds like San Antonio is well on its way to being that. And I think institutions like the Health Think Tank and Texas Biomed are vehicles to getting San Antonio there. So I am very proud to be joining efforts with you all. And when Larry reached out and showed me all that is Texas Biomed, I could not help but say yes. I think his vision for Texas Biomed is one that is very easy to get excited about. It's, you know, I told him, I said, this is a rocket ship and I want to be part of building and riding this rocket ship. So I am so excited to have joined Texas Biomedical Research Institute. This is, for me, I think this is just over 30 days now on the job. And it's a clearly a jewel of San Antonio, and it's one that I am honored to be a part of, and one that I'm honored to be able to play a role in stewarding. And I think you all around the screen and on the Zoom call are part of what makes Texas Biomed great as partners of the institution. So I'm really excited about getting to meet you all, getting to know more about you and the think tank, and finding ways to collaborate closely in the coming years. Texas Biomed, I think, is a gem, like I said. It's one that is recognized as a gem within San Antonio, and my hope and dream is for the world to see it as that gem and to connect the dots between the global health machinery and the great global health research that's going on at Texas Biomed. And so I'm looking to bring my contacts, my network, bring all of that to bear to support Larry and JMO's vision to take Texas Biomed from a jewel of San Antonio to become that national and global jewel. So thank you for the opportunity. Looking forward to getting to know you all and working with very closely with you all.
Okay, and I would like to say something. We welcome you from Baltimore. you came just in the nick of time, but I think he brought some of your weather down here yesterday. So thank you for that. So we're delighted to have you in San Antonio. And some of you heard her mention JMO. JMO is on the call. And JMO has been a speaker of ours on numerous occasions, both virtually and in person. And he is the chairman of the board. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah.
He's my boss.
So, well, you got a great boss. It's a great team that you've got over there at Texas Biomed. And so we love having you here in San Antonio. And I know for those of you who are part of HealthCell in San Antonio, they will also be, I'm glad we beat them to the punch, but they will also be speaking. Both of you will be speaking at that. So that's I'll great. Do a plug for the HealthCell here in San Antonio. I posted a question in the chat box on this morning's news. It was announced that $1.95 billion has been committed by the government to with Pfizer. Tell me how you feel about that. Have you been involved in that process and working on that, Larry?
Yeah, so I've not been involved in the, government. The government's come all in through Operation Warp Speed and supporting companies to accelerate vaccines to market. The fact that they're giving back that money to Pfizer, all of you know, Pfizer's been in this business a long time. They have a tremendous infrastructure, and they are doing everything right. I'm not promoting their vaccine. I'm simply saying that they have the EQ to do the preclinical pipeline and the clinical trials properly. And they also know about the trials and tribulations. So, they're in a good position. Moderna, which is a lead candidate, is a new company, newer company, and to date, unproven, but they have a chance. So I think what's happening here is, and what's different about this pandemic is politics, which is really messing up the communication. I think there's no doubt that the phase three trials, you're already seeing some of them slow down. There are problems, unforeseen adverse events, recruiting issues. I think we will know a lot more in November and December about safety and efficacy. That we will know. So I think things are moving fast enough. But to move from safety and efficacy to distribution, I think is a pretty big hurdle. So I think manufacturing, and I think I see a question here about each manufacturer doing things differently. I think that's a really spot on concern because of this issue about QA and QC on manufacturing. I know that over 100 different manufacturing plants have been communicated with to say, can you come on in? Because there's a desire to have infrastructure in the US, even though this is a global initiative and really to get the job done, to get billions of vaccines out. So I do think that it won't happen right away. And I think it's possible that on a small scale, that there can be some decisions made by the CDC and the NIH and Operation Warp Speed, et cetera, on some of the people who really need a vaccine in a small distribution strategy over the first quarter or two in 21. But I think it's going to be 21 or 22 to get broad distribution. And don't forget, I think the current lead vaccines are at least going to be two shots, at least a month apart. So, you know, and then it takes time to get immunity. And we don't really know how long that immunity will last. So, you know, I think there is going to be some time lag here, even though it's sounding like it's tomorrow. I don't see it that way. I think it's overly ambitious.
Okay, other questions? I know. The one thing that concerns me is how we can sustain ourselves for such a long period of time.
Larry, there is a question in the chat from Alex, and she says, and it kind of is along what you were talking about, will there be another virus in the next few decades that's like COVID-19 that impacts our lives in the same way? Obviously, you guys have a way of looking into those things ahead of time and know things we don't. But if so, how will Texas Biomed help to make response to infectious disease more proactive now and into the future? You were talking about being proactive before.
Right. Well, I mean, there's no doubt there will be more outbreaks and pandemics. Two economists now predict infectious disease to be the number one killer of humans by 2050 above cardiovascular disease. And that's for a variety of challenges, the ongoing global problems with malaria, TB, HIV, the super bugs that you all hear about in the hospital that you know can impact something called sepsis, which is the number one killer in this country in hospitalized patients, a number of challenges. But with regard to pandemics, they will occur. This is three times now with coronavirus, so there will be a fourth. And the concern would be that the death rate is even higher. So I think that developing this new vision of a infrastructure that includes academia, the private sector, industry, and government in an ongoing organizational structure is going to be the answer. And I think that's the way you can resource it so that the resources don't go away. We would have had an Ebola vaccine before the outbreak in Western Africa if money hadn't shriveled up. We would have had a SARS vaccine if money didn't shrivel up. So, I do think in the end, it's going to be partnership models and public will for resources. Right now, the good news is the public is very engaged. Now they're getting all kinds of information, but I think everyone is beginning to understand how it's infectious disease that shuts down the world. That's what infectious diseases does. And so therefore the risk for not being proactive is very high. And and I'm hopeful that Texas Biomed plays a role in that systematic change by developing those partnerships I talked about today. So yes, I'm optimistic that we will change the way we do business. I have to have a shout out to San Antonio because, if Larry comes to town, what city in America wants to put Ebola in their city? I can't build this in any other city in America. I can't. And the fact that it's been here for nearly 80 years, doing the kind of research we do and the community is supportive is really the secret sauce, I think, for helping an organization like ours succeed.
I'm from El Paso, born and raised in El Paso. They've got a terrible situation going on there. Do you think anything has to do with perhaps people from Mexico coming over across the border and bringing it with them? Have you any idea?
Well, I don't think that's what's happening. We have micro environmental transmission going on in just about every city in America right now. So this isn't a transport virus. It's worldwide for sure, but it's clear that we have cluster outbreaks going on. You know, you mentioned it a few minutes ago, we have fatigue going on. I mean, we've been at this since March, And I get it. You know that we're entering a season where 7 viruses give us runny noses every winter. So you can imagine now, as runny nose and sore throat increases, how everybody will go running for a SARS-CoV-2 test. And, you know, the answer, and I talked with Graham Weston about this yesterday, is what's called multiplex technology, which will allow us to do quick testing for the 7 viruses simultaneously. So we can tell someone, you have parainfluenza, you don't have SARS-CoV-2. But viruses clearly are more sustainable in the cold winter months. People are indoors. This is going to be a very tough period of time. I'd say buckle up and let's help each other. Let's understand that by helping ourselves, we're helping others and do the right thing. But I think it's microenvironmental spread that's going on here, to answer your question, Linda. I do see another question about BARDA. So BARDA is the arm of Health and Human Services, HHS, that protects the public from threats of variety of sorts. Now, lately, it's been focused heavily on infectious diseases. So BARDA has a very strong relationship with Texas Biomed, and we're in negotiation to have even a bigger partnership. We are currently considered one of their strategic partners. So whoever asked the question, I think Marty did, Landon, BARDA is an important player here, and I think we'll see more of BARDA. They're funding a lot of these studies that are going on today. I'm looking at the time, so I want to answer some of these. San Antonio's response, you know, the mayor and the county judge come on at 6:13 every evening, for those of you who are not in San Antonio, reporting the numbers, and we just went up. We have some growth of COVID-19 in San Antonio. I think San Antonio has done a solid job, really, in its messaging. I think it's been consistent messaging, which has been helpful. And I think that, by and large, San Antonians are trying to do the right thing. You know, I don't think we're perfect, and I think we have our outbreaks too. And I think, you know, the universities become a challenge, bars, et cetera. So it's not perfect, but what I'm happy with is the consistent messaging in the city, and, you know, allowing people to hear the same thing every day. I know Judge Wolf every day says physical distancing and mask, but it's good. It's good. It's said frequently to the public to understand that.
And you can brag a bit that you have not had one outbreak in your primate population.
Right. And we test the primates, and we have not. We've had 3% of our employee base have SARS-CoV-2. I'm sure all of you who have businesses have had some cases. Ours have come from the outside. We have no evidence of transmission within Texas Biomed. But we have a very active pandemic response team. They meet twice a week, and we report out to the Institute on behavioral changes and physical changes on a weekly basis at the Institute. Fundraising, how are the efforts going? Well, you know, you're talking to the CEO, never good enough. We have tremendous support. I really thank people, a lot of people, for that. But we have a lot of strong needs. And my commitment is that a supporter becomes a very close colleague. There are many ways we can do that, a partner of the Institute. And I'm focused on accountability and return on investment for any contributions made. So yeah, we're on a steep curve. And Dr. Anya Wu has big shoulders to fill there and bringing us global efforts in our fundraising efforts. But they're going along. But if any of you are interested, go to our website, and it's pretty easy to see how you can make a contribution, or just reach out to me.
Well, and you might as well, let's do a little plug, Larry. You need some more buildings.
Yes.
That is an old facility. Yes. It started in 1941, I think, was when Tom Slick started. It was under another name at the time, but—
Southwest Foundation.
They have some major capital needs, right? Yes. And now you're buildings, I read somewhere, buildings that you had already closed down for renovation, you've had to reopen because you've run out of room.
Right. You're right. And we brought in flat architects from Madison, Wisconsin to do a master planning exercise with us. We have a complete monetized master plan. We have our vision in place, and I'm happy to talk about it. You know, they're immediate, near, mid, and long range goals over 10 years. But we definitely have some capital needs to help us sustain our mission. So thank you, Linda, for allowing me to spend a couple of minutes on that.
I bet you there was even some naming rights.
We're very flexible and many opportunities. Everyone's a little different what they want, but we can satisfy everybody. That's not a problem there.
Okay.
I just want to echo that. We certainly do have a lot of opportunities. And so Larry and I look forward to hearing from folks on this call about that. If you're interested, please reach out. We're open for business.
Okay. Well, I did want to express that. I know there's lots of people that are interested in that type of investment opportunity. So we can certainly try to help you. So any other questions before we say goodbye and thank you very much?
There's DARPA DITRA question. So those are Department of Defense funding. And the Department of Defense is partnering with HHS through Operation Warp Speed. So there are opportunities for partnering there as well to answer the question from, this is from Byron Hepburn. And of course, I haven't mentioned to this point, but I should. I talked about the secret sauce being San Antonio, but I have to say that the entire military presence in the city fosters support for infectious disease threats because our soldiers are out in the world being exposed to a variety of these threats. And there's an understanding in the city, Byron can talk to this more, about the importance of the mission. So, you know, that's another unique aspect of the city that I think helps support. And you know, I for one have loved the collaborations that are coming up all over the place with the community partners, both in the private sector and universities. We're working together because again, as I pointed out, that's the way you get the job done. You know, you don't, siloism doesn't work. It just doesn't work. You don't get to transformational change by working in a vacuum. You have to learn how to work together.
So, okay. And I would say do we still have Marty on? Marty, you there? Okay. The organization you were talking about, it is a great, great partnership, and they're going into schools and testing kids and teachers and everything else. And it's a citywide collaboration. Graham's taking it to there's Richie. He could talk about it.
Yeah, Richard would like to talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah. So thanks for the plug. So we actually met with Larry and a couple others yesterday, had a really, really nice meeting and just getting great support of this vision that Graham Weston has had. And he's partnered up with the Gronkowski Foundation, the Tobin Endowment. And we've started something called Community Labs. And basically the idea is asymptomatic population testing, primarily focused on schools, but any kind of what we call micro population. So it could also be for companies. And we're actually also doing it for the city of San Antonio, just for general population testing for people that are asymptomatic. And so Graham and the team has partnered with BioBridge Global, actually with great thanks to Larry who recommended us to Graham. And so the lab is actually set up here at BBG. And our folks are actually operating the lab. And anyway, it's just a great collaboration. UT Health San Antonio has been instrumental in helping us set this up. And we started with Somerset Independent School District and are now moving on to many more school districts. We're ramping up literally from right now doing 1,000 tests a day to within a couple weeks be doing 10,000 tests per day. And soon thereafter, we'll be able to do 20,000 plus tests per day. So it's a very exciting thing that is basically unique, not 100% unique San Antonio. It's being done in Boston with the Broad Institute. And they were the trailblazers and we've learned from them. And but it's a very exciting project.
And it will probably be replicated across the country. Hopefully that will end up happening. Sadly,
I went ahead. And I was also say that what we are creating is literally an open book that's sort of open source to be able to share with other communities with the way that we've done it.
Sadly, however, that was where they are running this entire project was our old San Antonio chapter meeting room.
That's where we're doing our convalescent plasma.
Okay.
Which is a different project, equally important. The room where this wonderful group is typically met, we're using that to take donors who've had COVID to take their plasma, and that's is basically one of the therapeutics that Dr. Schlesinger was talking about, that we can try to make people well. There are folks who are in the hospital with COVID. So two different COVID projects we're working on.
Okay. I forgot about that.
Larry, can I ask you a quick question?
Sure.
Are there any companies, any stocks we can still invest in that we can afford?
No, I will not answer that question.
It's not insider trading, but we would certainly wish any clues about companies maybe to invest in.
Right. I've been asked this question, Brian, many times.
I can't imagine you.
I can't say. I will tell you that we just signed with Novavax. So that's another one company that is entering phase three. They're behind Moderna and Pfizer, but they have unique technology that might lead to a stronger immune system. Look, this is all theoretical, Brian. Unfortunately, we have to wait phase three trial results to really understand whether we've got something. Often lead vaccine candidates aren't the best ones. So, we're just going to have to wait and see, unfortunately.
Well, I mean, who knew this was going to happen? Look, I can't imagine what Netflix and Zoom is trading at right now.
That's true. Zoom has done great business. But if you go back to quotes from me from the early 2000s, I was talking about this pandemic back then. I was on television a few times during the Ebola outbreak about the next pandemic. So those of us in the business know it's not an if, but a when. But it's time to act. And I love, Linda, that you've invited me to speak here today, because the more knowledgeable and engaged all of us are in understanding its importance to each one of us, none of us are spared from an infection in our lifetime, which has impacts. And it's just a matter of getting the message out. And thank you, because an audience like this allows me to do that.
Well, I wonder if it's possible that you could send Linda
you'll get it.
Presentation, I would love to send it to my younger son who is in Portland, Oregon, and he graduated from Reed College, and he works in a biochem lab in conjunction with the hospital and university up there. So, someone like that would really appreciate, seeing your presentation.
We can talk about it. You can let me know. And sure. Brian, do not buy Pfizer. Not a good one to buy. They just went.
I know, it's too late.
The announcement. Yeah,
it's too late.
Okay, I'm gonna let everybody go. Thank you very much for being with us. And I thought it was a great presentation. And hopefully we'll see you soon. And Akuto, I look forward to meeting you in person one day or rubbing elbows.
Same
with
here.
You.
Yeah, same okay. here. Same here, Linda. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thank you all.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Appreciate it.
Stay safe.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. That was awesome.
Thank you. Thank you, Melissa.